Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Kat Kinsman of CNN's online food site Eatocracy not only reports on food news, but is a newsmaker herself. Kat joins us for an in-depth look into the online world that is her life. Then, we catch prolific cookbook author Kit Wall as she puts the final touches on her latest book, New Orleans Creole Classics. Kit does it all. She cooks the food, writes the text, and handles the food styling, photography, and layout design as well. I think you'll be fascinated by the process. I am. All that fun and more on this week's Louisiana Eats. Kinsman is the managing editor of CNN Eatocracy. If you want to know the current food news scoop anywhere in the U.S., you want to know Kat. Kat, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Oh, thank you for having me.
For those people who may have never heard of Eatocracy before, would you explain about the content you can find there?
Oh, sure. So we are the food blog for CNN, and we've been around about 3.5 years. And we cover everything from national food news, food safety, food policy. But my very favorite thing that we do is letting people who are involved in food, whether they're chefs or farmers, enthusiasts or experts, tell their story in their own words. And that way we can get the flavor of what's happening around the country and in some cases around the globe.
How do you meet and identify these folks?
Eatocracy is run by me and by my fantastic colleague, Sarah LaTrent, who has been there the whole time. And we talk to people from all over the country and say, what's happening in your area? What do you love to eat? People find us online. They find us on Twitter. And we just have conversations with as many people as we possibly can. Food is a big and beautiful thing. And I've realized along the way that you can talk with absolutely anybody in the world about food. Everybody eats.
It is the universal language. And you and I had the great fortune of meeting several years ago when you all began doing what you called Eatocracy Secret Suppers across the U.S. And New Orleans was one of your first stops. So how'd that special evening all come about?
We started doing these suppers where we thought we would get together people from all different walks of life, farmers, fishermen, policymakers, musicians, chefs, people who had something to say about the culture of a particular place. And we would get them together around a table for a meal and all have just a discussion that varied from city to city. We started it out in Atlanta and we talked about what is Southern food. In New York, we talked a lot about cultural identity and how food fit into this. And of course, in New Orleans, we had to talk about how it defines you as a person from New Orleans.
You recently teamed up with another buddy of mine, Kim Severson, who, of course, is with the New York Times. And you two created quite a stir at the annual Southern Foodways Alliance in Oxford, Mississippi. Now, Kat, just tell me, what was that that you and Kim did up there?
So during the Southern Foodways Alliance Symposium, they've started doing a Lincoln Douglas style debate. And John T. Edge, the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, had come to us a few months ago and said, I want you two to debate pie versus cake and what those mean in the context of Southern womanhood. And you two just have at it. So Kim's a good friend of mine. And so we had met a little bit beforehand to talk about what the tone was going to be, how much trash talking was going to go on, and sort of what our points of view were going to be. But otherwise, we did not disclose too much to each other ahead of time. We showed up and there was a pie-shaped podium and a cake-shaped podium. And we just went at each other hammer and tongs on what pie means, what cake means. I went for 10 minutes. She went for 15 minutes. And then I got the 5 final minutes for the last word. And I argued very much from the heart, very passionately on the side of pie and what that means. And Kim gave a fantastic historical context to cake. And we tied.
You tied.
We tied.
Oh, well, that's democratic.
Well, everybody won because they served pie and cake from the fantastic baker Lisa Donovan from Husk. So the whole debate is available online, by the way, video of it. I went into Domenica the other day, and all of a sudden some dessert showed up at my table that the pastry chef had made, and she had written on it, "Are you still on Team Pie?" in chocolate. So it's following us.
Oh, that is great. Now tell me, when you come here, what are your must-do eats and drinks?
Well, you know, that changes every time. And this particular time, my husband was with me, and this is his second trip here. So we knew we had to do a long Friday lunch at Galatoire's, which I had been once before and he had never been. And we put out on Twitter, what should we eat if we're going to do this correctly?
Uh-huh.
Of course, everybody was saying to go for the double header, to stretch out your lunch until it's dinner time and then do the two for there. But we got the trout almondine. We got the brandy milk punch. Oh, those souffle potatoes. There's nothing in the world with a texture quite like that. Got the Café Brûlot. Our fantastic server, Amber, set the tablecloth on fire. We don't get this food outside of New Orleans. So that is spectacular. We make a point of going to Cochon and Cochon Butcher every single time. I try to get as many oysters into my face as humanly possible while I'm here. I actually ended up the other night in our hotel gym at midnight after having two different dinners and a very long lunch just so I could eat more the next day. And I woke up this morning and ate a quarter of a muffaletta in bed.
You're my kind of girl, Kat Kinsman. Now, Kat, one of the things that you are the most adept at, more than really almost anybody I know in media, is social media. And I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about your experience in social media, what works for you, and how it's changed your world and the world of food.
It's undeniable, the power of social media these days. And I know a lot of people like to write it off as, you know, at Twitter especially, as being silly about just sort of broadcasting what you're doing throughout the day. A lot of the people who I follow on social media are farmers and chefs, and they're giving insight into the process of how the food comes onto your plate or comes into your store. And you're just getting these little windows into places you would otherwise never get to see, whether it's coming from a fishing boat, from a field. There's this one farmer, Brian Scott, who I follow very avidly. I was watching today on social media as he was posting pictures as he was harvesting from his soybean field. And these things are going to end up on somebody's plates. And it's a great way to know exactly who the hands are that have touched what you're eating. I know if I go to a different city where I've never been before and I say, hey, Twitter, feed me. And I started a hashtag at one point, Twitter, feed me, and just saying, like, I'm near this particular corner. Tell me where to go. And people are really generous with their information and they want to show the best of their city. So they'll say, you should go there, you should go there. One of the best experiences I ever had with that, I was in Providence, Rhode Island, and I was there for a sad reason. My uncle had passed away and I was going to the funeral the next day. And I just needed to have a quiet dinner out by myself and, you know, somewhere near my hotel. And I asked people, if you were going to be in Providence, you know, for a solo dinner, where would you go? I ended up going to this great place called Two Rivers. And I was sitting there at the bar, ordered my food, and this other plate sort of came out. And I thought, oh, you know, maybe they gave this to me by mistake. And they said, well, the chef knew that you were having a hard time and you were here for a sad reason, and he just wanted to make your day a little better. And it was, I started crying there at the bar because it was somebody I'd never met before, and he wanted to reach out with just a gift of food. And that happened because of social media, and that's just one of my favorite stories ever.
Which is your favorite platform these days?
I love Twitter because you can bring together a whole lot of different forces. You can share pictures directly from Instagram, which I especially love because you have a visual on things. Yesterday, I was out on a swamp tour and took a little 16-second video of just the boat going down the swamp. And that way, I was able to just bring people along on my journey as I was doing that. And you can wrap a whole lot into Twitter now that you can include video and pictures there. And it's spontaneous. It's quick. You can follow and unfollow people. It's not a huge commitment. And it's right there in your pocket at all times.
Okay, Kat, I know after this initial meeting here on Louisiana Eats, all of our listeners are going to want to be able to check into the wild, wild world of Kat Kinsman. So how can they do that?
Well, first they should go to etocracy.com. That's at CNN. You can follow me on Twitter at Kitten with a Whip, or you can follow me on Instagram at Kat Kinsman, and you're going to see a whole lot of food that's pretty familiar to you because I've been taking pictures all over town.
You never stop. You are just the social media maven, and I want to thank you so much for coming to see us.
Oh, thank you for having me. My life is never more delicious than when Poppy Tooker is in it.
Kat Kinsman, the managing editor of CNN Etocracy. Roving reporter Chris Jay covers northern Louisiana in his weekly food blog, 20by49.com. Chris, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you for having me, Poppy. It's always such a pleasure to be here.
So what should we be hungry for from the North Louisiana area today?
Well, if you ever find yourself in Bossier City, you've got to look up a place called John's Seafood. It's really interesting because no one named John works there, and it's not just seafood. It's sort of a quick-to-go fried food joint.
Uh-huh.
But the owner of the place, a guy named Chef Tommy Lee, specializes in Chinese-style hot pot cuisine. For some reason, in this little to-go fried seafood joint, you can get a fantastic Chinese hot pot.
So describe for our listeners, what is a Chinese hot pot?
Well, if you're going to order a Chinese hot pot, you want to bring about five friends, okay? You're going to gather around the table, you're going to order it, and they're going to bring a burner to your table, a Sterno burner, and they're going to put it on the table along with a big vat of soup stock that kind of tastes like Chinese tom yum soup. So yes, it's really flavorful, lots of lemongrass in there. And depending on what kind of hot pot you order, they're going to bring tray after tray after tray of raw ingredients for you to cook fondue style at the table.
What are your choices?
Oh, you can get anything from oxtail to seafood to vegetarian to any sort of tofu you can imagine. So at this little drive-through fried seafood place, you can go and have a terrific Chinese style seafood fondue meal.
That is so fascinating. And how's the fried seafood?
It's good, too. I mean, but every time I go, I'm tempted. I just got to call some people up, and we're going to go and have a hot pot. I like planning the hot pot experience because you get to kind of figure out how to make the perfect bite. I think I'll pair a clam with a shrimp with some heads of broccoli in there, and we'll throw it all in there, and we'll just stab it up and eat it. It's wonderful. You're cooking it. You're eating it. You're responsible for everything. It's fun.
Now, on the menu, this, I imagine he's an Asian man,
yes.
Chef Tom.
Chef Tommy Lee.
So this is the only Asian thing on the menu,
there's
right?
There's one. Well, you can get a wide range of Chinese and Vietnamese food there.
Oh.
Some of the better spring rolls in town. The menu's crazy. You look to the left wall of the restaurant, and it's framed photos of fried catfish fillets. You look to the right, and it's different kinds of bun, which is like a Vietnamese noodle salad. And to top it all off, it's ridiculously named. There is no John there. It's John Seafood, right?
Yeah.
But what about that would make you think you could sit down to a Chinese hot pot?
Now, Chris, I know that you know all the food secrets. So is there anything else that we should know that Chef Lee is famous for?
You really should know about his Peking duck. The thing about Chef Lee is he used to work at a lot of the riverboat casinos.
Uh-huh.
And he developed a reputation for just being a master of the Peking duck. So now when Chinese American high roller gamblers are are playing at the casino and they want a special meal, the casino heads, like the floor bosses, will actually call Chef Tommy Lee and ask him to prepare a Peking duck for their client. So if you're ever at John's Seafood in Bossier City, Louisiana, know that millionaire high roller poker players are dining on his Peking duck, and you may want to try it yourself. Or just get some spicy catfish fillets. You never know. You know, keep it simple.
Well, that is delicious. And thank you for taking us to yet another exotic eating place in North Louisiana.
Thank you, Poppy. I always enjoy seeing you.
Our Louisiana Eats roving reporter, Chris J. You can learn more about North Louisiana's food scene by visiting Chris at 20by49.com or by visiting us at LouisianaEatsRadio.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Next, prolific cookbook author Kit Wall welcomes us into her home studio, where she writes, cooks, styles, and photographs her beautiful books. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's.
I'm Kit Wall. We're in my studio where we write and photograph cookbooks, among other things.
I've known Kit Wall for many years, and her Garden District home studio is a bustling place. She's an artist, a sculptor, a photographer, and a master at writing recipes. In just 8 years, Kit has produced 11 cookbooks as part of a series entitled New Orleans Classics. I wanted a chance to see this amazing work in progress, and Kit agreed to share her secrets with not just me, but my Louisiana Eats audience as well.
We decide what recipes we want, and then following that, we decide which chefs have the best example of that.
Ah, and so most of the recipes in the bulk of your books come from New Orleans restaurant chefs?
Yes, restaurant chefs, because they cook it more often than any of us. They know more about how the dish goes together, and they've made improvements to it. Every single chef improves a dish every time they look at it. And they would make gumbo much more often than anyone except perhaps you. Or whatever the recipe is. So we get the recipe from the chef, and yes, chefs give recipes if you ask nicely. So we rewrite the recipe, we test the recipe, we make sure the recipe tastes like the restaurant dish, because you would not want to prepare Commander's bread pudding souffle and then have it turn out differently than you had it at the restaurant.
Today, Kit is working on her latest cookbook, New Orleans Classic Creole. Her mise en place is carefully laid out with perfectly sliced green tomatoes, all ready to fry in a smoking hot black iron skillet. The boiled shrimp and chilled remoulade sauce are all ready to dress out the crispy bed of greens. You see, all the food for photography is cooked right there in Kit's kitchen.
Well, we've photographed all of the recipes now. We've tested them and photographed them, but the taste and how it looks are sometimes two different things. And two of the recipes that we shot, we're not quite happy with the way the shot turned out.
What are some of the problems that...
Well, the Joanne's fried green tomatoes with shrimp remoulade, the photograph doesn't do the dish justice. It looks flat, so we're plating that dish to shoot it better. You know, we're not looking for a beauty contest here. We want to make it appealing. And this is actually some very nice fried tomatoes. They show enough green. that we know what it is. But I'm going to overlap them a little bit, again, to give it dimension, which we were lacking in our first shot. So I think this is where we want, but that's the prettiest one, so I'm going to put him there so it shows on the height. And we want six shrimp that are about the same size, and we have them here. That one's too large. I really admire the chefs that just do this innately. They know what they're doing, and they do it 1,000 times a week and have it right every time. If you want humility, hang out in a restaurant kitchen for a while.
What is the difference between how you're composing a plate for the camera as compared to how it might be in a restaurant when they put it down in front of you?
Well, in a restaurant, they've probably coated the shrimp completely with the remoulade, and there's a lot more remoulade probably on the fried green tomato. So what we want to do is, in a photograph, try to separate the components out a little bit so we can see them individually and see them as a whole.
Honestly, Kit, it's a very pretty plate. It looks better in the picture than it does in person.
Shame on you. This is the magic of computers. Now look at that.
Beautiful.
Can you get prettier than that?
It looks like it's ready for the book.
It is. It is. Yay. One down, 800 to go.
Often, to get those perfect food shots, it requires 800 takes. But that's why Kit's photographs are simply so delicious, you want to lick the page. I was curious to learn just how long the whole process takes.
Generally, with our publisher, the classic books take about 6 months from start to finish. Maybe a little longer, maybe 8 months, depending on how fast we are.
What do you think the hardest part of all this turns out to be?
Turning it in.
Meeting the deadline?
No, not meeting the deadline, letting it go. You see your baby leave, other people get to play with it.
And when Kit's new books appear in the stores, everybody can't wait to play with those delectable dishes. Cookbook author Kit Wall in her New Orleans studio. The afternoon we spent with Kit Wall, she was redoing a shot of fried green tomatoes topped with a shrimp remoulade. It was clear just from watching the cooking process that getting those tomatoes just right was a big part of the challenge. Here's how Kit does it. Slice green tomatoes into half-inch pieces. Heat some vegetable oil in a heavy skillet. Kit prefers to use cast iron. Then dip each tomato slice in buttermilk and dredge in flour. Make sure to get both sides fully coated. Carefully place each slice into the hot oil and cook until golden brown. Turn the tomato slice over and repeat the process on the other side. Then place them on paper towel to remove any excess oil and serve while still warm. They're delicious topped with shrimp remoulade, but honestly, fried green tomatoes are good all by themselves. If you'd like a copy of Kit's recipe, visit our website at LouisianaEatsRadio.com. One thing I know for sure, Kit Wall's fried green tomatoes are real Louisiana Eats. Most new cookbooks pass through the hands of Times-Picayune food editor Judy Walker, making her the go-to expert on what's hot on the cookbook scene. So, Judy, what are some of your favorites this year?
Oh, my favorites this year include the John Besh cookbook, Cooking from the Heart.
Yes.
Because it revisits these areas in Europe that were so important to him. And he's got great stuff about La Provence and when he worked there with Chris
Caracajou.
That's very charming. Very charming and, like, you know, useful in many things. I also really like John Currence's Pickles, Pigs, and Whiskey cookbook, recipes from my three favorite food groups. And if you know John Currence, you know he's just a hoot and a half.
Yeah.
And his food is so good. He's from New Orleans, but he's been in Mississippi so long, he's like the king of – he's the big bad chef.
Yeah.
He's literally the big bad chef.
That's the name of one of his restaurants, yeah. Right? Big Bad Breakfast.
Big Bad Breakfast, yeah. And his Twitter handle is Big Bad Chef. So
yeah,
he has got a lot going on. And his cookbook is very charming. He tells a lot of great stories about how he learned to pickle and can from his grandparents. He spent summers on their big farm helping them pickle and can. So he loves that.
Really?
And pickles everything. Yes.
Okay. So who surprised you?
This James Villa Southern Fried book surprised me. I don't know why, but it did. I thought he had already done a Southern Fried cookbook, but no, he had not. But this is all about frying everything in the South. And he's got like 27 cookbooks. He's written a million things. He's very well respected. So this is a new take on this old, old, old thing that he rightfully points out Southerners are very good at.
How much do the visuals make a difference to you?
Some. There are a lot of cookbooks that don't have visuals, but of course there are some that you do give a lot more points to because they do have very appealing visuals. The John Besh cookbook, his third cookbook, it actually has step-by-step cooking lessons that
you see in
a lot more books now because he is trying to make that more of a teaching cookbook than his first two cookbooks were.
I really do like that technique, mm-hmm. you know, that mm-hmm. is several images, sometimes over two pages.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really helpful for the mm-hmm. home cook.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, you would be an excellent person to evaluate cookbooks because, after all, you are a cookbook author yourself.
Well, yes, for many years.
How many books have you written?
I have written or co-authored, I think, six now.
Wow.
Two of the Southwestern ones are still in print. And then the Cooking Up a Storm cookbook, which was 5 years ago this year with Marcel Bienvenu.
Yeah, and that is a seminal cookbook.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled to think that.
Well, it's true. I think it's a cookbook that absolutely everybody needs on their cookbook shelf if they care about the food of New Orleans. I learned so much about that.
And thank you for saying that.
Well, it's really true. You know one of the lessons I learned in Cooking Up a Storm? You know, you have things in there that are so obscurely difficult to find.
Like Corinne Dunbar's.
You took the words out of my mouth.
You were the first person to contact me who had made a recipe, and you said this is exactly the way it tasted because we didn't change the recipe to modernize it.
For those of you who have never seen that recipe, it's Corinne Dunbar's most famous oyster artichoke appetizer, but it was the classic thing at the old Corinne Dunbar's on St. Charles Avenue that virtually every dinner started with, and it was positively yummy. And modern cooks have a tendency to read an old recipe like that that says canned mushrooms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the snobism in modern cooks, we all go,
sure.
Canned
fresh
mushrooms.
Best. Fresh is best.
I wouldn't use
that's
canned.
That's the modern mantra.
But you know what? That is the number one place I learned that if you really want to recreate that taste memory,
mm-hmm.
you've got to follow that recipe and use the right ingredients. It's like when I make my great-grandmother's peas in a roux.
Mm-hmm.
I was a snob for a long time about it,
mm-hmm.
and I would use frozen green peas because they're almost like fresh. And then one Thanksgiving, I was doing my grocery shopping, and I looked at that end cap full of those Sour petit pois, and I thought to myself, you know, those canned peas are there on that big end cap for a reason.
For a reason.
And I made the recipe with the petit pois in the can, and I'm never going back, as God is my witness. So let's just recap a little bit about those recipes from Cooking Up a Storm? And what are some of your favorites? And what were some of the hardest ones to hunt down?
One of my favorite recipes in it that I have made over and over again is, we call it Better Than Better Cheddar. It's a recipe I got from somebody in Uptown New Orleans years ago.
Yeah.
And it recreates a dish that is commonly sold at every place, every grocery store around. It's called Better Cheddar, and it's this wonderful cheese. It's chunky cheese spread. It's sort of more like pimento cheese, but it's not pimento cheese. It's like smoked Gouda and sharp cheddar.
Yeah.
And it makes a ton. It makes like 2 pounds of this cheese spread. It's really good. What's funny is people in New Orleans think it's from New Orleans.
Oh.
They just assume it's New Orleans.
Well, we take ownership of everything. It's kind of one of our problems in Louisiana. Because remember, Judy, the name of this show is Louisiana Eats.
And that's what your book is all about, Poppy.
Oh,
so
Judy.
You need to talk about your book that came out this year. Talk about how you picked those certain subjects, because you've interviewed a lot more people than you were able to cram into the book.
They were my favorite stories. Mm-hmm. They were the stories that stayed in my heart, that really rung true with me. And the book is pretty heavily weighted with mm-hmm. some surprising stories about food and race. Barry Martin, mm-hmm. the young British jazz drummer who discovers segregation for the first time in the early 60s and then gets threatened by the Ku Klux Klan when he joins the Black Musicians Union. And what does that have to do with food? Well, it turns out Buster Holmes was his best buddy. And
that's
how he came to talk on Louisiana Eats in the first place. And then, you know, I just have to tell you, the big boys do cry. What did you think about the Brett chapter?
Oh, my goodness. That was so moving. Brett's work is just impeccable.
It is.
He's such a good writer. And he has to work so hard to do what he does. And I could not do it. It's the most difficult job on the paper.
Amen. I am so glad he's back. Thank you, Judy.
Poppy, thank you for having me. This was really fun.
Times-Picayune food editor and cookbook expert, Judy Walker. We'll be right back with photographer David Spielman to hear how he captures a life story in a single frame. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. David Spielman is a photographer and author whose books include Southern Writers, Katrinaville Chronicles, and in 2012, his profiles of New Orleans musicians called When Not Performing. David worked as the photographer on Kit Wall's first book, The Arnos Cookbook. And he's also my collaborator on our new book, Louisiana Eats. David, welcome to the radio show, Louisiana Eats.
It's an outstanding pleasure.
I want to talk about the places where our visions altered. And two of my favorite people over in Southwest Louisiana are Carlos Knott of LA 31 Brewery and the famous Louis Michaud of the Lost Bayou Ramblers. And so much of their story has to do with Bayou Teche. I want to talk about the places where our visions altered. So what happened?
So I got over there. Mm-hmm. We set up on the bayou. But the shadows, the busyness of it didn't translate. And it quite honestly looked too forced.
Uh-huh.
So up on the road was this beautiful old barn or a structure. So I asked Carlos, what's the story? And he told me, this barn had been there for a very long time, And it was where they housed World War II German prisoners. So you can see in the picture the wood, the angles of the wood, the texture of the wood. And that felt more like a South Louisiana musical situation.
Yeah.
And this would be where some guys on a Friday afternoon or at a picnic would set up and start playing. And that's what they did. And you just can't imagine how much fun to sit there and listen to these guys goofing and playing. You know, that's one of the real treasures of what I get to do.
The other thing about that particular picture that you really captured that I love is that Carlos is old enough to be Louis's dad, but they have a relationship of complete contemporaries. And they have such an intense mutual admiration for each other. And the way that they are looking at each other in that image, you got it.
Yeah. You know, I tell people that music and food are the two great generational bridges, because you learn from your grandmother or an auntie or somebody about cooking. You sit at the apron of. Same thing happens in music. The young musicians sit on the porch while the older ones are playing. And so there's this great understanding. And quite honestly, you take it a step further, musicians and the cooking were the predecessors to the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, right here in South Louisiana, we have these great lessons. I mean, you know, the black musicians are sneaking into the white bars and the white guys are sneaking into the honky-tonks to hear the music long before it was permitted.
Well, now that you brought up one of my favorite topics, which is food and race, there's the great story of Rudy Lombard, who was the person who ended racial segregation in restaurants in New Orleans, Lombard versus Louisiana. And he had told me that he was inspired to do that because when he was a little boy, he played on the street corner right across the street from Pascal Minnelli's.
Yeah.
And he saw those white people going in and out of the restaurant, and he knew inherently that he couldn't go in there. And so he said to himself, one of these days, I'm going to go in that restaurant.
Sure.
And so that was such a fun afternoon we got to spend together with Rudy at Minnelli's and the barbecued shrimp. Tell us about how you staged that photo.
Well, we had a huge obstacle. They were putting the new drain system into Napoleon Avenue. And so we had to kind of figure out a way to shoot. So I shot from a little bit of a lower angle. So you can see the top of the house, you can see the oak tree, and you can see the awning of the restaurant. And then we just sat there and started talking. And the camaraderie, the conversation between you and Rudy were just exceptional. And so he's completely at ease. And so we talked and we laughed. And, you know, it one moment, unplanned, he just kind of holds his wine glass up as a toast. And there was a shot. When I see it, I know I've got it.
Well, you got it, baby. The last image that I really want to discuss, it involves a sound that you hear on the streets of New Orleans, the hooves of a mule. And then if you're lucky, you hear the ringing of a ship's bell, and that announces that the Roman Candyman is coming down your street.
All right.
So how did you do this picture?
I try to show something different. I want to show the inside of his wagon, the tightness of the proximity of the space that he has to work in. And so I asked permission, as you do with a ship. Captain, may I come aboard, please? And he kind of looked me over and he said, okay. So I got up in there, and it's unbelievably tight quarters, but there is form and function to every inch of the place. I had to use a very, very wide angle lens, but I wanted to show him, because 99% of the people in this city, they see him from the torso up. And what a special person. And he is aware of the tradition that he is the keeper of. And that's the other thing that I find wonderful.
Well, I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart of agreeing to be my collaborator, my partner in crime on this project. And I hope you're getting as much of a kick out of having it in print as I am.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And please don't lose my phone number because I would love to work with you again and again and again.
Thank you, David. New Orleans-based photographer David Spielman. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's culinary heritage hero is the last of the original street vendors in New Orleans. You know our hero is coming when you hear the sound of a ship's bell ringing, accompanied by the noise of mule hooves on the streets of uptown New Orleans. Our culinary heritage hero's grandfather originally began operating the mule-drawn cart in 1915. The candy, which has always been made on the cart, came to Louisiana with our hero's Sicilian great-grandmother. Our hero's grandfather passed away in 1969, leaving New Orleans without our precious candy for 2 years. But our culinary heritage hero came home from the service and literally took the reins of the mule-drawn wagon, bringing Roman taffy candy back to the streets of the Crescent City. Our hero goes to extraordinary lengths to maintain the tradition of the mule-drawn cart, stabling the mule next to his uptown New Orleans home, and learning to repair the cart's wooden wheels himself when the city's last wheelwright died over a decade ago. That's why Ronnie Kottman, our very own Roman candy man, is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Ronnie can be found most afternoons on the streets of Uptown New Orleans, bringing sweet delight to taffy lovers everywhere. When you see him, remember to thank him for perpetuating one of our dearest culinary heritage traditions. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Roman Taffy Candy is real Louisiana Eats. That. Generally, that's not a positive word these days. But in fact, we need fat in our diet, and it's simply an important part of our eating experience. Here to help us make all the smarter choices when it comes to fat in our diet is our Louisiana Eats medical consultant, Tim Harlan, also known as Dr. Gourmet. Doctor, welcome back.
It is great to be back, Poppy.
Okay, fat choices. Give us some.
First and foremost, you do not need to eat a low-fat diet. Okay, we now know that that was some flawed science. And the best quality science we have now says that probably 35 to 38% of your calories should come from fat. Well, what does that work out to? For most people, that's going to work out to somewhere in the neighborhood of about 3 tablespoons of fat or the equivalent a day. And I think that people have this idea that all fat is bad and, you know, I can pick up a low-fat food and it's going to be better for me. That's not true. We need fat. The challenge is a lot of us get too much fat. So it's not necessarily low-fat. It's just lowering the amount of fat that you're consuming, which also helps you lower the amount of calories.
Yes.
But also the ratio, the quality of the fat. So we like saturated fat, but we like less of it. So you want about, for every, say, teaspoon of butter, you want to be having about a teaspoon and a half or so of canola oil or olive oil. So you want a higher ratio of polyunsaturated, monounsaturated fats like canola oil, grapeseed oil, olive oil, sesame oil, peanut oil, etc., and less saturated fat like butter or lard.
Okay, so you've sort of debunked this low-fat diet. There's so many different elements that you have to consider when it comes to fats in food, and one of them is actually cooking with them.
Right. I tell folks, start with a really great quality extra virgin olive oil.
Yes.
We know that's going to be monounsaturated, really great quality fats. And that you want to use the extra virgin olive oil for things you're not going to cook with. So that's mm-hmm. going to be for your salad dressings, et cetera, sauces that don't get heated up too much, because then that beautiful flowery flavor of the olive oil comes through.
What happens if you heat up extra virgin?
Nothing really happens to it necessarily, except you're just kind of wasting your money because all
gotcha.
That nice fruity flavor gets lost. So
yes.
I keep a virgin or a light olive oil on hand for cooking when I maybe want a little bit of fruity flavor in there, and I still want a lot of great quality monounsaturated fat. Canola oil is a great choice because it has virtually no flavor at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other fat that I tell folks to keep on hand is either dark or light sesame oil, because when you use a sesame oil, that's going to be for your Asian dishes.
It's a perfume.
It is. You know, you put a little dark sesame oil, a little roasted sesame oil in a wok, and you know you're instantly going to cook something Thai or Chinese or Japanese.
And delicious.
And delicious. So those are the four major oils that I say, you know, keep these on hand, small amounts if you don't cook a lot, because oil does go rancid after a while,
yes.
as you know. And then butter.
Yeah.
Now, I like butter for that fifth fat to keep on hand, and you want to measure it. You want to cut it out. You don't want to just throw a big old glob of butter. And the place to use it is to, again, enhance flavor, enhance that nice mouthfeel, that creamy texture to a sauce or a dressing, or when you're finishing off a little steak or something like that. It doesn't take much. It takes a half a teaspoon, maybe a teaspoon. And that's all.
Well, I know that before you were an MD, mm-hmm. you were a professional chef.
Right.
And I have to admit, there's something in cooking that I'm very confused about. Frying.
Right.
I'm talking about hardcore frying. So I know the Italians fry in olive oil.
They do. They do. You know, people tend to fry, cultures tend to fry with what's available to them. You know,
mm-hmm.
in the South, we have traditionally fried in peanut oil because that was what was most available. And that matters a little bit. And the thing that I like that you said a minute ago is we're going to deep fat fry, or we're going to fry something every now and then.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not about fried food being bad for you. In fact, I'm writing a column right now and experimenting with some fried chicken, with some gluten-free fried chicken recipes and such. And, you know, fried chicken is great. I mean, I grew up on fried chicken. Fried chicken every day, fried
yeah.
chicken two and three times a week. And this is, I think, the challenge for a lot of us, is that easy access to lots and lots and lots of fried food.
So, Tim, when you get this gluten-free fried chicken down, will you come back and talk to us about that?
Absolutely.
I can't wait. Thank you. Louisiana Eats medical consultant, Dr. Gourmet Tim Harlan. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, NOLA Pie Guy Nate Winter shares tips on creating that perfect holiday pie.
Too often recipes call for sugar. Everyone just goes to the cupboard and gets that big bag of white processed sugar. Try cutting half of that with some local raw sugar. There's some beautiful dark brown sugar here in Louisiana and South Louisiana. So try cutting half of your sugar with that raw sugar and you get a really beautiful molasses feel.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org and louisianaeatsradio.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickey Brennan and Company, an LCI workers' comp. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh, consulting producer Margaret Howes, and sound engineer Guy Mulladew. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.